Israeli reaction to an American senator's call for the two-state solution.
But I think people feel like it may not be his place to say these kinds of things. And that, you know, it's one thing if Israelis say it, and it's another thing if American senators say it.
Plus, at least 16 killed in a Russian attack on Odessa.
A paramedic and a member of the state emergency service who came to begin the rescue operation after the first missile attack were killed during the second missile attack that hit the same place.
And a growing humanitarian crisis in Nigeria and a computer problem may be ruining lunch around the globe. Today is Friday, March 15th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel is denying reports that its forces killed innocent people in aid centers. At least 29 Palestinians were killed while awaiting aid in two separate Israeli attacks in the Gaza Strip on Thursday, this according to Gaza's health ministry. In the first incident, Palestinian health officials said eight people were killed in an airstrike on an aid distribution center in the Al-Nusrayat camp in central Gaza. Later, at least 21 were killed and more than 150 wounded by Israeli gunfire at a crowd awaiting aid trucks in northern Gaza. Again, this according to the Gazan Health Ministry. Israel's military denied attacking aid centers, describing the reports as false. All of this as an aid ship organized by the World Central Kitchen is waiting off the coast of Gaza to deliver nearly 200 tons of supplies for Palestinians after arriving from Cyprus early Friday morning. And another developing story from the region. Hamas has proposed a six-week ceasefire in exchange for the release of dozens of hostages. Gil Dickman is the cousin of a hostage. He expresses the optimism and support for the deal that is shared with many family members of the hostages and their supporters.
Last night, Israel finally received the answer from Hamas, and that we understand that a deal is actually reachable. There's something on the table, and it's something that we've been waiting for a long time. We know that this might be the last chance to save the Israeli hostages and to bring them home alive. Most of the hostages are still alive, that's what we understand, and we believe that this is the last chance. This is money time. This is why we're here. Family members of hostages and many other Israelis who tell the government, you have all the backing you need to make this deal happen and bring the hostages home.
The offer from Hamas comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu convenes his war cabinet in Tel Aviv and discusses sending Israeli troops into Rafah, the last refuge for more than a million civilians. It also comes after American Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer gave a speech on the Senate floor calling for elections in Israel and an independent, demilitarized Palestinian state. VOA's Linda Gradstein joins me from Jerusalem.
Well, I think there's been kind of a mixed reaction, and it sort of depends on your, you know, how you are looking at what's happening in Gaza. But I think most people were a little bit put off and saying, okay, this is an American senator, and, you know, yes, he's Jewish, but, you know, he doesn't live here. He's not facing the kinds of threats that Israelis are facing. And that what he's doing is making Israel such a partisan issue by saying these kinds of things on the Senate floor and personally attacking Netanyahu, even though the level of approval that Netanyahu has in Israel is quite low. But I think people feel like it may not be his place to say these kinds of things. And that, you know, it's one thing if Israelis say it, and it's another thing if American senators say it.
I think that's probably a fair criticism, but is there any credence given to the fact that as a Jewish American, Schumer's Jewish American perspective is one that hasn't been really on the forefront lately?
I think there is. Look, you know, Israel is both the state of all of its citizens who live in it and the state of the Jewish people. And therefore, you know, American Jews have something to say about what goes on in Israel. And there has long been a conversation, although a lot of Israelis say it's one thing to criticize Israel privately, and it's another thing to criticize Israel publicly. And I think that, yes, he's an American Jew, but he was also speaking as a senator, as an American official. The truth is, in Israel, I think most people, according to the polls, still support the goals of the war, still want Israel to continue the war into the southern city of Rafah, still feel that Israel cannot have any kind of long-term peace deal if Hamas remains in Gaza.
You mentioned Israeli support for going into Rafah, and apparently Netanyahu is making those plans. Can you tell us what we've learned today?
Yes. So the Israeli war cabinet met, just finished meeting, and at least according to the Israeli press reports, Netanyahu approved an army plan for the operation into Rafah. Now, Rafah, by the way, is where there are more than 1.5 million Palestinians living. In other words, anybody who has fled the fighting from the north and the center of Gaza has moved to the south. And both President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken have been very sharp and saying to Israel, before there's an operation in Rafah, where Israel says there are still 4 Hamas battalions and where there's a tunnel structure underground, you have to figure out a way to move the civilians out. Now, Israel says it will move the civilians to what it calls humanitarian islands, where they'll be able to provide food and water and medicine. It seems to me somewhat difficult to understand how you're going to move 1.7 million people. So if Israel really does conduct an operation into Rafah, which, by the way, some of the army generals have said would be a mistake and that the death toll among civilians would be very high, it's going to be kind of messy. So even if Israel moves half of the civilians, which, again, you're talking about large numbers of people, Gaza is so crowded. But that's what the press reports are saying, that Israel has said from the beginning, and Netanyahu has repeated it over and over, that the two goals of the war are to free the hostages and to destroy Hamas as a military power.
Any indication when this might happen?
No idea. Although, I think we're talking about, days or weeks, not months.
We'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks so much for your time today.
Sure. Thanks, Steve.
And now in Europe, Russian forces launched another massive aerial attack across Ukraine, including 2 deadly missile strikes on the city of Odessa. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
In the early hours of March 15th, Russian forces conducted a massive drone attack across Ukraine, targeting Kirovohrad, Mykolaiv, Kharkiv, Kherson, Khmelnytsky, Vinnytsia, Kyiv regions, as well as the capital city of Kyiv. Also, early on March 15th, Russian forces launched 2 missile strikes on the city of Odessa. At the moment, 16 people are confirmed killed and 73 injured. A paramedic and a member of the state emergency service who came to begin the rescue operation after the first missile attack were killed during the second missile attack that hit the same place. There are several serious injuries among the paramedics and rescue workers. As the rescue operation is ongoing, more than 200 Odessa residents have donated blood for the victims of the attack, and about 100 more are queuing at the blood reception points. Additionally, 2 people were killed by Russian drones in the Vinnytsia region. Also, in the early hours of March 15th, Ukrainian drones allegedly attacked another oil refinery in the territory of Russia in the Kaluga region, Ukrainian media reported, referring to anonymous sources in the intelligence service. Reportedly, this facility was used by Russia for military purposes. In New York, Ukraine called a special meeting of the UN Security Council. This was announced by the permanent representative of Ukraine to the UN, Sergei Kislytsa, on X on Friday, March 15th. Kislytsa wrote, "The Security Council will convene at 3:05 p.m. on Friday, 21:05 Kyiv time, for a meeting requested by Ukraine to discuss the illegitimately attempted so-called presidential elections that Russia is organizing between 15th and 17th March in temporarily occupied Ukrainian Crimea and in parts of the Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions in Ukraine. Russian Federation is holding presidential elections between March 15th and March 17th, 2024. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Once a major force in the Russia-Ukraine war, the Wagner Group is being rebranded as an expeditionary corps that is now under the control of Moscow's military intelligence arm. And the force is offering a regime survival package to autocratic regimes in Africa. This according to a report from Britain's Royal United Services Institute. VOA's Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
Russia's Wagner paramilitary group was active in several African countries, including Libya, where its fighters aided General Khalifa Haftar in return for access to Libyan oil and gas. They were frequently accused of committing human rights abuses. In June last year, Wagner's chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, led a failed mutiny against Moscow, and the group was disbanded. Prigozhin died in a plane crash 2 months later. That left a dilemma for the Kremlin: what to do about Wagner's operations in Africa. Oleksandr Danilyuk is an associate fellow at Britain's Royal United Services Institute.
After that so-called mutiny, the decision was made it would be better to have it more, you know, in-house rather than outsourced.
According to an analysis by Britain's Royal United Services Institute, or RUSI, Moscow has rebranded the Wagner Group as the Expeditionary Corps of Russia's military intelligence agency, the GRU, with a target of recruiting a further 40,000 troops to serve in the force. Its aim is to secure Russian interests overseas, including access to mineral resources, while also reducing Moscow's vulnerability to Western sanctions, according to the report. Again, Oleksandr Danilyuk.
What they're doing is just expand a colonialism in the global South countries. And right now they're very much focused on African countries, but they have plans for Latin America as well, some Asian countries. They will also have, you know, political technologists, media experts, intelligence officers who specialized in political warfare, economic operations. So pretty much everything to be able not only to infiltrate that global South countries, but also to establish pro-Russian regimes there.
Moscow is actively marketing that offer to African governments. Again, Oleksandr Danilyuk.
They sell this conception as so-called regime survival package.
The RUSI report says Russia helped to foment military coups in parts of Africa and is now seeking to displace Western influence. France and other European nations sent troops to Mali in 2013 to help fight an Islamist insurgency, but they were withdrawn in 2022 after a military coup. A UN peacekeeping force also pulled out last year. Several hundred Russian-backed fighters are now in Mali supporting the junta. Moscow has also backed military governments in Niger and Burkina Faso. Speaking Wednesday, Russian President Vladimir Putin denied any plan to oust Western influence from the region. Putin said that Russia does not have such national tasks at the Russian state level. We're just being friends with them, that's all, he said. The RUSI report disputes that assertion and says that Russia's new expeditionary corps shows Moscow has finally decided to explicitly challenge the international system. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. There's a growing humanitarian crisis in Nigeria. We'll learn more in a moment. Now, though, to Somalia, where the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab terror group has claimed responsibility for an attack on a hotel in Mogadishu that's often popular with local politicians. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
Attackers stormed a hotel near the president's office in Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, on Thursday. That's according to residents who reported hearing two explosions followed by gunfire. Al-Qaeda-linked group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility and said they had besieged the Sil Hotel, a popular gathering place for politicians. On Friday morning, Somali security officers could be seen taking positions on the hotel's roof. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for an attack on the same hotel in 2019. The jihadist group has, for years, been trying to overthrow Somalia's government and establish its own rule based on a strict interpretation of Sharia law. Police and other government spokespeople were not immediately reachable for comment.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting for us today. And the medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says Nigeria's northwest region is experiencing catastrophic levels of malnutrition and disease as it copes with a decline in humanitarian support. They say that all of northern Nigeria remains affected by high levels of conflict. The humanitarian needs of the northwest, though, have yet to be provided for under the National Response Plan. Timothy Obezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
In a media statement this week, Doctors Without Borders, known by its French initials MSF, said the failure of authorities and donor partners to formally recognize the crisis in northwest Nigeria is delaying the much-needed response. The warning is not the first time the aid group has raised the alarm about the situation in Nigeria's northwest region. MSF said more than 500,000 cases of severe acute malnutrition in Nigeria can be found in the region and that 854 children admitted to its facilities last year died within 48 hours of their arrival. Abdullahi Muhammad Ali is the MSF head of mission in Nigeria.
We have been communicating and advocating with relevant actors to alert on the situations in the northwest for the past few years, but the region has never been included in the UN humanitarian response plan. We are deeply concerned given the seriousness of the humanitarian crisis in this region, home to around 50 million people. The level of malnutrition and outbreak of preventable diseases are catastrophic in the context of persistent and relentless violence.
Northwest Nigeria has been hit by persistent violence perpetrated by armed gangs who often kill, loot, and take hostages for ransom. MSF said that last year alone, more than 2,000 people were killed in hundreds of reported attacks. But humanitarian aid groups have largely focused their attention on the northeast, site of the long-running Boko Haram insurgency where Nigerian forces are stepping up attacks against the Islamist militant groups. Ali says the situation improved briefly in the northwest last year.
We have seen some little improvement in 2023, with few actors mobilizing to provide support to vulnerable people. But this is far from being enough, and the medical aid is just a drop in the ocean. We would like to see a collective and a concerted strategy by both the humanitarian community and the Nigerian government in order to scale up the humanitarian response plan.
MSF says it treated 170,000 malnourished children in the northwestern states of Kebbi, Sokoto, Zamfara, Katsina, and Kano last year for severe acute malnutrition, a 14% rise compared to the previous year. Nigeria's Humanitarian Affairs Ministry did not respond to calls for comment, but an official who did not want to be named said the probe of Humanitarian Affairs Minister Beta Edu has affected planned responses to humanitarian emergencies. President Bola Tinubu suspended Edu in January over alleged misappropriation of funds. On Wednesday, Nigeria's parliament asked the president to hasten the suspended minister's probe. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Turkey's defense industry claims to have entered the exclusive club of stealth jet manufacturers with last month's first flight of its Khan fighter jet. But as Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, analysts say the stealth jet is yet to prove itself.
Ankara is presenting the successful test flight of its stealth Khan fighter jet as a national triumph. The Khan was developed in response to the US decision barring Turkey from buying the American-made F-35 combat jets after Turkey bought Russian anti-aircraft missiles. Turkey says its rivals are rearming with America's new jet, and Ankara said it had no alternative. Mr. Jarshan is a presidential advisor and professor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
The excessive armament of the Greece is a big threat for the Turkey and agency, the balance of power. On the other hand, ongoing wars in the Middle East have necessitated the urgent modernization of the Air Force. However, we have to underline that the U.S. embargo about the F-35 regarding the CASA, the sanctions.
Turkey's defense industry has already established itself globally with its armed drones, now widely used in conflicts from the Caucasus to Syria to Africa. The drone development came after the United States refused to sell its Reaper drones to Turkey. Analysts say Ankara sees its defense industry as vital to its foreign policy. Suat Delgin is a retired senior naval officer and now an independent foreign policy and defense analyst. He says Turkey thinks the less dependent it is on foreign countries in the defense industry, the more autonomy it will gain in its foreign policy. He says in this respect, Turkey is primarily trying to be as independent as possible. Ankara, meanwhile, presents the Khan jet as a breakthrough for its rapidly growing defense industry, placing Turkey among the few countries that build a stealth jet. Analysts say the Turkish arms industry remains relatively small, still relying on foreign imports for key components. Siner Özkarashahin is an independent defense analyst.
There's been quite a significant improvement, but also the Khan incident illustrates the foreign dependency in critical subsystems and critical segments, such as the power packs, the engines, still continuing.
American engines power the Khan jet, but Ankara claims to be developing its own. Analysts say Turkey's already identifying markets for the Khan. Again, Siner Özkarashahin.
What's important that it will fill in the demand in alternative markets in countries that cannot access the F-35 technology, be it economic reasons, be it political reasons. So Azerbaijan and Pakistan and possibly Ukraine are some examples where Khan can really make a difference.
Turkey's drones followed a similar strategy in finding a niche market. But analysts warn developing a stealth combat jet is far more challenging than making drones, and the Khan jet still has a long way to go before it's combat ready. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
And finally, today, while it might not rise to the level of a true global crisis, it is for many a lunch crisis, as McDonald's restaurants all over the world are experiencing computer outages. Restaurants were closed or operating at a diminished capacity in several countries, including the US, UK, Canada, Japan, Thailand, and Australia. A company representative said the outage was the result of an IT glitch, and not, as some had feared, a cyber attack. And that's going to end today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.